Hi, everyone, and welcome to the DieCast. I'm your host, Josh Veal. With me, as always, is Seamus.
Hi there.
Chris.
Hello.
And Mumbles.
Sup.
Rutskarn could not join us today on account of Mumbles is here.
Yep, we're the same person.
Oh, I thought you just, like, killed him and stuffed him in a dumpster somewhere, but... Okay, that works, too. So, today we have lots and lots of news, and the most prominent of the news is clearly that in the Nintendo Direct on the 29th, Nintendo announced that they're doing even more new 3DS models.
Because there weren't enough.
Two new models, in fact. A new normal 3DS and a new XL 3DS.
There's more buttons.
Yeah, they've added a new analog nub.
These names are a disaster waiting to happen. As I understand it, the new ones, the games for the new ones will not work on the old ones. So calling all this stuff 3DS.
Yeah, there will be exclusive content for the new 3DSs.
So that is really... we have the 3DS and then the 2DS, but wait, there was the DS and then the 3DS.
Well, no, because it's worse than that. Because there was the DS, and then there was the DS Lite, and then there's the DS XL, and then there was the 3DS, and then there was the 3DS XL, and then there was the 2DS, which was actually the new 3DS, which had no 3D, and now there's the new 3DS, which is not the new 3DS, that's the 2DS. The new 3DS is actually its own system that actually comes as a new 3DS or new 3DS XL. I'm confused.
Yes, especially since the numbering goes backwards there for a minute from 3 to 2. How is this not going to result in people buying games that they can't run?
You think they fire their naming department after the Wii U, but go ahead, Mumbles.
It after the Wii.
The fucking thing about Nintendo is that most of the people who buy Nintendo games are children, which means that their parents are buying the games, which means a parent walks into the GameStop and goes, I would like a 3DS. Oh, you want a 3DS? Do you want a 3DX XL or their new 3DS? What's the difference? Well, the 3DS XL is larger, and the new 3DS has a nipple on it, and it's also...
That's exactly how I would describe it.
That's why I don't work at GameStop.
If you look at our handy flowchart...
These are the games you can play on the nipple 3DS. These are the games you can play on the 3DS XL. Like, it's so fucking stupid of them. Like, adults... Like, most parents who are buying games for their kids don't know everything about video games. They don't fucking check the internet for gamer news. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, they don't fucking know, and you need to make it easy for them to be like, alright, this is the new thing that I need to buy my kid. It's just basic business.
Well, even then, there's the compatibility issue, where you still have 3DS games coming out, or DS games coming out and on the shelves, next to 3DS games, and now you're going to have DS games
Wait,
next to 3DS games
DS
next to new
games
3DS.
Really still coming out? Like, new ones that are not just, like, weird Japanese things?
There were a few recently. I want to say that the Adventure Time game came out on the DS as well as the 3DS, but I may be wrong there. But regardless, they're still on short store shelves. I don't know if you've been to like a crappy Walmart or Target or whatever, but DS games are still very much in stock. Of course, you know, PS Vitas are still in stock
right.
here too.
You know
so.
What's even worse? Yeah, right. What's even worse is if, oh, I want to buy the new 3DS game for my child, I will pick this up from the shelf and buy it. And then you go home and you're like, here you go, child, I bought you the new 3DS game. I love you very much. Thanks, Papa. I will put it in my new my regular 3DS. Oh no, it's a game that's for the new 3DS. Like, how many fucking parents are gonna make that mistake? Like, I just...
Christmas is... Nintendo is gonna ruin
fucked.
Christmas.
Yeah.
Also, I just don't get the point of it. Like, I understand that they want to move more hardware units, and it's like the easy, lazy answer, but...
I wonder if this is a Japanese thing. I wonder if their product naming in Japanese or just in Japan culture is a little less insane, like if they're a little more familiar with that sort of thing. But here in America, we expect, or here in the West, we expect, hey, new product, not compatible, give it a new name, a distinct name.
Okay, but like they did that for the Famitsu, which became the Nintendo Entertainment System in the US and Europe. So, I mean, they already changed the names, like, from the very beginning when they just got into that. They were changing the names for Western markets, so I'm not sure I buy that as an excuse. Unless they've just gone completely crazy, which, I don't know, you never know with Nintendo these days.
But, I mean, like, beyond the branding, I mean, yeah, the name's idiotic, but... Wait, you're adding essentially a little nipply nub for what is essentially at this point camera control. No one's going to want to do analog stick dual input. Like, you're not going to be making a two-stick shooter with that little thing. No one's going to want to do that. You're basically having it be this little camera adjustment.
Well, apparently it has like a different CPU in it, a faster one.
Right, and I mean, but that's what I mean, is it's sort of like this lazy man's new hardware, where it's like, take the thing we already got, slap some better CPU in there, slap some a little bit more RAM, add a little nipple, add two more back buttons, there's an R2 and an L2 now, and call it a game system, and release it, and
it's basically
be cool with it.
A DualShock with screens on it now.
And that's what it is, and that's what I'm saying, is like, I don't know... At least with the DS, and even to some extent the 3DS, you could tell that they were trying to aim the hardware at a very different market than what the PS Vita was aiming for. They were going very broad and very, very, very selling the novelty, I guess. Selling the novelty of a touchscreen, of two screens, of 3D, etc. Now they're like, it's just a hardware bump. You know, it's about as iterative as Apple's crap is, where it's like, we're going from Gen 1 iPad to Gen 2 iPad, and we've upped the resolution a bit, and there's some more memory, and that's it. And it's just a very un-Nintendo move, and I don't think I get what they're trying to do with it.
It's a little weird seeing them throw on all these new buttons. Like, do they not have the touchpad being used anymore?
I think that might be a response to the fact that so many things were, like, not portable to the 3DS. So now that they have all the major buttons you'd be wanting to use, there's two analog sticks, there's two triggers. Aside from R3 and L3, you have pretty much all the buttons a regular standard home console would have.
Yes, because if there's anything, any Nintendo platform that needs to be able to get third-party ports, it's the 3DS.
Exactly. Well, exactly. Like, the 3DS should, the whole gimmick of it should be, we have games that no one else can fucking put on their handhelds or their consoles. Like, that should be the fucking gimmick.
You know, I have this, like, this weird scenario in my head where, like, how weird would it be if... For this next console generation, whenever that happens, or maybe like halfway through this one, who knows, Nintendo basically does a complete 180 on the past 10 years and goes, okay, we're just going to make like a normal game console now. None of this like motion control, touchscreen, like double screen crap. We're just going to make a new home console that is just like the PlayStation and Xbox One, and that it is a thing that you play games on, play normal games on, and then they just, like, release that. How weird would that be?
Weird, because at this point, I don't know if they can compete, because even the PS4 and Xbox One aren't just game systems. I mean, the PS4 tries to target itself as that, but they have a lot of media support. The PS4 is a Blu-ray player. The Xbox One is a TV pass-through. Nintendo has invested about
Nintendo
zero research.
Always, yeah. Go Nintendo ahead. Doesn't give a shit about any of that stuff. Nintendo doesn't want to be a home center, like the way that Xbox wants to be a TV center or whatever the fuck. Nintendo wants to be a game console. That's fucking it.
So what if, like, they took that and threw out all the peripheral crap and said, like, we're just going to make a console that is like, say, halfway through this generation, they release a new console that is, like, slightly more powerful than the PS4. It goes on sale for less because now it's cheaper to make PS4-level hardware, and is just a game console.
They'd still
they might. I was reading an article the other day how Miyamoto was talking about how he doesn't respect casual gamers. Like, he only respects hardcore gamers now. And that's to me,
a weird thing for a Nintendo guy to say.
Yeah,
at this
point. It's a total 180 to me because
are you planning on taking Mario to the PlayStation now?
It's really weird. Customers, and he only respects people that buy from the competition.
His reasoning, and honestly, like I told you guys, my E3 story with Miyamoto, where he is working on this robot game, and he had one of the developers play it as a demo, and the developer sucked at it because the game wasn't very good, and you could see this look on his face that was like, no one can play this game that I really want to make. And I wonder if there's been like a shift in his attitude because he has all of these ideas because he's always been an ideas guy. And maybe some of them aren't good. And also the only people who would play them are fucking hardcore Nintendo fans. So I don't know. I might be just something he's going through. But what he said was, he thought casual gamers suck because they're passive. It's just so insulting. Casual gamers want to be entertained. They don't want to work hard at anything, so therefore they're not real gamers, where hardcore gamers will work really hard for something. It's so fucking just backwards. It's so fucking wrong. But that's what he said, and so if that's the direction Nintendo takes, what would even happen?
I'm curious of that. I'm sure some of that was his personal opinion, but I wonder how much of that is also stroking investors down because they have not been particularly happy about the way Nintendo has been performing.
Yeah, there were some rumors like a month or two ago that there was a lot of like dissent towards aimed directly at Iwata. As the head of the company. Supposedly they were debunked, and I didn't really read too much into that, which is why we didn't bring it up on the diecast before, but...
Well, there was the whole thing earlier this year with the whole, like, waiting until 2 days before the board meeting to announce that revenue was going to be slashed by, I can't remember what percentage, but a percentage that is larger than you would wait 2 days before a board meeting to do. So, I mean, it's... I don't want to get too far into the Nintendo circle jerk thing of Doom, but people do overstate that. Nintendo is not in trouble in a sense that Nintendo is facing an existential crisis. Nintendo is just not making enough money to make investors happy, and I think there is a lot of pressure to find new ways to generate revenue, and this may be one of that.
Nintendo's in a weird spot as far as money goes, because unlike all the other companies that are big players, they have a whole lot of extra, like, I guess just a rainy day fund, like in the excess of $13 billion or something like that, just sitting around in the bank, you know, in the event that they aren't making money.
That's smart to me. So many more... I wish more companies did that. Everybody's like, we gotta spend, and we gotta make money, and we gotta make big, bold moves all the time. And then, you know, a sudden shift in the market. Oh, we blew a bunch of money launching a new console, but all of a sudden, you know, handhelds became big, or there's this other thing, and we missed that opportunity, but we have no money in the bank, and now we have to start panicking. Having a huge war chest is one of the reasons Nintendo can afford to be so kind of slow moving. Like, they don't make big radical moves, and sometimes that works against them, but in principle I think it's a much better I think it is a much more mature way of running a business.
So when we hear like, oh, Nintendo's in trouble, they're not really in trouble. They're not in like this sort of trouble that Sony as a whole, like not just the games division, but the entire Sony electronics company is kind of in trouble at the moment. They're not like that, but they're just not making money. They're losing money. And so as far as drastic moves go, Nintendo, it's difficult to tell with Nintendo when it comes to that. Well then, that has been our daily Nintendo segment. I guess some more monthly. Not a lot of other news this week. Of course, by the time this goes up, there will probably be plenty of news because we're recording this like one day into PAX, and presumably there will be, you know, some information that comes out of PAX that could be worth talking about. There's you'll have to wait until next week for that.
There's a Super Meat Boy Runner. It's like
the Super Meat Boy game nobody asked for.
Yeah. Is it exactly like the other Super Meat Boy game?
No, it's a Super Meat Boy runner, like an infinite runner game. So imagine Super Meat Boy, except with a procedurally generated level as you keep running, and it's gonna be released on Steam, but it's also an iPhone and iPad game where you tap to jump, and that's what it is. It's one of those runner games.
Oh, that sounds fantastic for Super Meat Boy's difficulty of very precise jumps.
If they get the level design algorithm right, if they can get the algorithm right for the levels, it could be okay. I mean, it's not going to be Super Meat Boy, but it'll be...
Well, did you ever play BitRunner?
That game drove me nuts with its difficulty, but yes, I have played it.
If they make it like that, like, I know it was pretty fucking hard, but if they make it like that, or even levels of fucking Rayman, the new Rayman game...
Are you talking about BitTrip Runner?
Bit Trip Runner. My bad. I forgot that part.
Yeah. Oh, that thing. Oh, I got like 5 minutes into that before I hit the wall. Because, you know, I'm complete rubbish at platforming.
Yeah. Like, Nick is really, really good at platforming games. And so he sunk a lot of hours into Bit Trip Runner. And I'm pretty sure he's probably going to sink a lot of hours into whatever fucking Meat Boy game comes out next. It definitely sounds like a game that is... for people who already like platformers. Just like Super Meat Boy.
Did anything else happen at PAX that we know about yet that anyone wants to comment on?
No.
Star Citizen is still not out yet. I'm gonna stop before that becomes a rant.
Did you hear the Half-Life 3 announcement?
Yes, Seamus, we heard the Half-Life 3 announcement. It was right before an asteroid is coming to destroy the planet in 5 days announcement.
Yes, and the announcement was it's coming out in 6 days. So that was kind of a better thing for everybody.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of blaming Valve now for Armageddon, but, you know, to be fair, Half-Life 3, so it's worth it. Why don't we move into the Happy Haps section? Seamus, you said you had lots of stuff to talk about. Why don't we start with you?
Lots. I don't know about lots. A friend got me Sunless Sea. Yeah.
What sort of friend was this, Seamus?
Somebody awesome. Somebody who was completely awesome. Got me... Sunless Sea. Sunless Sea is by Fail Better Games. And they're the ones who did Fallen London. I don't know if anybody played. I played, I guess it's called Echo Bazaar. Okay, this is getting confusing. It's got like three different names.
Echo Bazaar is a name that rings a bell, and I remember Fallen London. Like, they renamed it to Fallen London, didn't they?
Yeah, something like that.
Every time I read or hear Fallen London, I think Hellgate London, and then I just go...
No.
I played the shit out of Echo Bazaar when it first came out. Holy crap. Okay,
yes,
cool.
Yes, Sunless Sea is like... You know, the problem with Echo Bazaar is it was free to play, and so you'd get really... Okay, for those who haven't played it, it is basically a... Echo Bazaar is a game, is a free-to-play game, but it's really, really based around story. Like, it's got all the... Not story, world-building, and I don't know what you'd call it, like, world-building text, like... mood setting text. It's all little snippets about this version of London that's deep below the Earth's crust and filled with all this gothic weirdness. Very Victorian styled thing. And it's just this feast of fiction to read. Like, you do a thing, you get a paragraph. You do a thing, you get a paragraph. You make a decision, you get a paragraph. You make another decision, you get a paragraph. And it's just this constant trickle of, like, cool, just constantly neat ideas, Cool imagery, weird characters, unsettling ideas. And then, oh, I ran out of turns. I go away for 4 hours and I'll come back and I'll play some more. Sunless Sea takes that same idea, only instead of, oh, I'm out of turns because it's a free-to-play game, you just buy the friggin' game. And in this version, you sail from island to island. This is an underground ocean you're sailing around on. And each little island is its own cluster of stories and people to meet and stuff to do. And you can just binge, or you can say, you know what, this place seems a little dangerous for me. Maybe I better bail and go back out on the sea. So it is Echo Bazaar, only better. That's my rendering of it.
And
so
you have
far.
A boat.
And you've got a boat.
That's awesome.
And, well, you've got, okay, the great thing is it's a little more mechanical. Echo Bazaar was a little shy on mechanics. There was some, like, oh, you do a thing and you get a paragraph, and then, oh, you collected this weird resource. And later on, you'll use that resource, but the mechanics were very shallow in Echo Bazaar. This thing is more video gamey. As you sail around, you're running low on food. You have to keep feeding your crew. And what do you do when you run out of food? Which I haven't done yet, but I'm actually low in my current game. So that forces you to pull over into these islands, look for food, and get caught up in their little adventures. So it is a feast for anybody that is really into Victorian fiction. Victorian, gothic, strange, Alice in Wonderland, only more so kind of ideas. Highly recommended.
You know, I know a guy who wrote a book in that sort of setting.
I know, right?
If I could be half as awesome as Sunless Sea, my book would have been a better bestseller. Or Echo Bazaar. Just whoever is doing the writing for this thing has a really strong style and lots of new ideas. I mean, there is just, it is constantly new ideas. It isn't like, oh, here's a Sherlock Holmes ripoff. Oh, and here's some crap about Scotland Yard, and here's a murder mystery. This is like really new out there stuff that still feels right. And that's Sunless Sea.
All right, then. Mumbles, what have you been playing?
I've been playing Wind Waker. I'm playing it seriously for the first time. When it first came out, I probably got up to the second temple, and I just kind of lost interest because I was a teenager, and I had other shit to do, which isn't... I was running drama department. Okay.
Wait, Wind Waker isn't that old, is it? How old is Wind Waker?
Yeah.
No, yeah, it was a GameCube game.
It came out when I was in high school, Seamus. So.
Yeah.
So, and like, Kimster's only a couple years older than me, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it came out. Anyway, so I got it in the HD version because it came free with Mario Kart. And I'm really enjoying it. And I'm probably going to eat my words, like, ask me again in about a month, but I'm actually enjoying the sailing part of it, because I know that was a problem that a lot of people had with the game. But to me, there's so much, it's going temple to temple to temple, and I need that, like, couple of minutes of sailing in between, or I have to, like, quit the game for a week, because the game's so action and puzzle heavy that, for me, I need, like, that time of just, like, oh, look, there's some birds, oh, there's a pirates, that's neat, see you guys later, I'm sailing. Like, I don't know, I kind of like
your palate.
Exactly, that's exactly what it is. And but I guess, I don't know. I'm sure that in a little while I'm going to fucking hate it, but I like it now. I've also been playing some TF2. Do you guys know that you can play the beta maps on TF2 now?
Yep.
Beta maps.
Yeah,
beta maps,
so
that are going to be real maps eventually.
Yeah, oh. And they have this new thing where it's robots. So you have to... There's two bases, and you have to destroy the other team's robots and then grab the intel and run it over. And it's
so
like in...
So robots are now in the multiplayer modes that are not co-op.
Yeah. But they're like these
That's
cute
weird.
Little robots that run on a track, and you have to kill them incrementally, so you kill the first two robots, and then you get access to kill the next two robots, and then, so you can't, like, work backwards or be sneaky about it. And it actually reminds me of the original TF2, because in the original TF2, the 2-Fort map was huge. It had all of these different, like, areas you could sneak through, big things of water everywhere, like, it was giant.
Do you mean Team Fortress Classic, or...?
Yeah, Team Fortress Classic. So, like, the... And I only know about this because the maps were converted by players, fans, into Team Fortress 2, so you could play those maps in TF2, like, as close to how it was in Team Fortress Classic. So I might be wrong, and people can correct me on this, but the maps seemed fucking huge, and it seemed like there was a lot of water everywhere, and a lot of places you can sneak around, and... This robot map is a lot fucking like that. There's a lot of areas you can sneak around. There's a lot of doors that stop you, and you have to go all the way back around in order to get out of that area. Like, it's kind of interesting. And I'm not sure how much it's going to change when it actually gets released. But I'm enjoying it a lot. I haven't had fun with TF2 for a while, but this is really fun for me, because it's something new, and it's not just a new fucking hat.
Yeah, I've been waiting for good new TF2 content for a long time, and that might be what would get me to go back, is, like, a genuinely new mode that isn't just doing another thing with the stupid cart trains. Like, now they go backwards and forwards, or some stupid crap like that.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a new game mode, for sure. And, it feels like it's meant for people who... have been playing the game for a while, which I appreciate.
At this point, that's pretty much everybody who plays the game.
Yeah, I forget how long TF2's been out. Like, I guess I started playing in 2009, so I've been playing for, like... But people have been playing, like, 3 years before that, or whenever the Orange Box came out. Yeah, so
that's
It's been around for a long time.
I think it was 2008, actually, yeah. Yeah, so
has it been out longer than it was in development yet? Because it was in development a long time.
Have they just been, like, waiting to have, like, multiple franchises where they can just release the third game so they can just do the 3 box and they can have Left 4 Dead 3, Half-Life 3, and Team Fortress 3 in it?
And then they could be sponsored by Reebok, so it's, like, the 3 box sponsored by Reebok.
And that's, like, the only reason they got Reebok as a sponsor, so they could have that pun.
I'd do it. You know I would.
Right. Yeah. Oh, wait, one more thing. And it's real quick. I have been burned by Batman stuff my entire fucking life, so I'm really fucking skeptical about Batman shit. But I watched the extended trailer, I think it's on Xbox, for the new Gotham show. And when I first started watching the trailer, I was like, whatever, this is lame. And then I got about halfway through and I was like, oh no, I love it. Like, the city design is really great. The ideas that they have are unique. And I don't agree with all the ideas, but it's something new. And everyone who's on the cast fucking loves the world and the characters and the ideas. So I suggest trying it, or at least looking at the preview for it on Xbone. Just
this
fucking try it out.
This is the series that's like what happened in Gotham before Batman became Batman, right?
It the first episode takes place when the Bruce's parents get shot. The very first episode. So it's kind of cool.
Another superhero origin story.
It's not a fucking superhero origin story. It's a villain origin story. That's why it's so fucking cool. It has nothing to do. I mean, there's some Bruce stuff.
So it's
some
following
really,
the Joker.
No, God damn it. Okay.
Mostly.
It follows Gordon. So Gordon is the main, like, good character. And the whole premise of the show is you don't know who's going to turn into what. Like, you don't know what this character is going to turn into necessarily.
Okay,
this guy is definitely the Penguin, but you don't know how he turns into the Penguin yet. And it's not going to necessarily follow canon. Or, yeah, this is Edward Nygma, but you don't know how he's going to turn into the Riddler yet. And they were talking about how there's a lot of characters on the show that you don't know are the villains. They don't necessarily give them names, or they give them names that aren't the ones that you recognize. So you don't know that they turn into certain bad guys. Like, they could have Clayface or Ventriloquist or some shit. So that's kind of like the main focus of the story. But then you have Gordon kind of learning to be a cop in this fucked up town. So it's about villain origin stories and Gordon. It's not about hero origin story.
Nygma's origin story is he's just out shopping at the thrift store one day and he finds this suit, this green suit with question marks, and he's like, this gives me an idea. And that's it.
You know what's funny is, like, so I've read every Riddler comic there is to fucking read, and my favorite origin story is he was a circus guy. He got bored conning people at the circus, so he became a bank robber. That's my favorite way to tell the story. But I don't think that is ever going to be Edward Nygma's origin story. And the reason why is because of technology. I don't think he will ever be that guy again. And it's really interesting that I'll probably never hear that as the Riddler's origin story again. It's probably always going to be something different. And I think that's
neat. I would love if he was portrayed as a Moriarty searching for a Sherlock. If he just, like, one person after another, he fools them and it's boring to him. And he keeps getting away with it.
And that's pretty much how it was in the original comics. The original comics was he became a bank robber and he was like, this is boring because I'm so good at it. And he's like, the one thing that he doesn't want is a job. Like, he doesn't want bank robbery to feel like a job. He wants it to feel fun. He wants it to be a game. And so that's why he starts doing the riddle stuff. And then Batman shows up and he's like, I can beat you. And it's like love at first sight for Riddler, because he's like, holy shit, there's someone that can play on my level. Like, oh my god, like, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
Like, if you could design his character to create this so that Batman doesn't exist in this world and you can see the need in this character for a Batman. Like, you could see that that's what he wants. That would be really cool.
I'm hoping that they do something similar to that, but I doubt it. I think people don't know enough about the original version of the character, and everyone goes off of the Batman Forever version where he's like this awkward nerd guy. Like, the original version is he was kind of a street rat, he was a con man, he was a arrogant bastard, and then he became Riddler. So we'll see.
So it's like if Good Will Hunting decided to become a like criminal instead of a super scientist or whatever.
Yeah.
Street rat, riff raff. I don't buy that.
Like, you could go the whole nine yards and have Andrew Scott play him.
Yeah, he'd be a really great. He looks like classic Riddler, and that's not who Riddler is. And Riddler now has red hair and green eyes. Riddler when he was first conceived had dark hair with like a little curl, just like Andrew Scott does, and dark eyes. And so if they went with Andrew Scott, that means that they're acknowledging how Riddler used to look. So it's just there's this new generation of Riddler now, and I have to just accept it. You know.
But back to Gotham, I haven't seen I don't think anyone's seen the pilot yet, but I really am interested in seeing how it turns out, because it's one of those ideas that's either going to be so brilliantly cool and awesome that it's going to be like, why didn't anyone try this before? Or it's going to be a hilariously terrible train wreck, because it'd be like, who possibly would ever think this was going to work? And it's going to go one of those two ways.
And that's why I was so skeptical about it, because it would break my heart if it was bad. Even if I knew it was bad, it would break my fucking heart. Like, anytime I see bad Batman stuff, it breaks my fucking heart. Every fucking time. So I'm hoping that it's good. I need it to be good.
Every time I see anything about it, I'm like, oh, wow, that does look surprisingly good. And then I remember the premise, and I'm like, well,
yeah.
There's nothing wrong with this premise, except that Batman is so overexposed. And it feels, what it feels like, before you know anything about it, it feels like, really, they are completely out of ideas, but Batman sells no matter what you do with them, so let's just keep finding new shit to do.
Well, there's this line that they have to walk, right? Like, from what I understand, Gordon's going to be the anchor, and you don't want it to be this thing where it becomes a police procedural in Gotham where occasionally we name drop cutesy character references to a future
Batman
events.
That's what I thought.
Because that's what everyone thinks it's going to be. What you need it, but you also don't want it to be like this crappy Fate thing either. Like, you don't want it to be too into like bringing the characters into the fold so that, you know, a 14-year-old Catwoman is helping Gordon solve crimes and then she, you know, befriends a criminal and it becomes like too obviously directed at the characters. What you really need is just a strong character drama anchored by Gordon as sort of the everyman, and then have these characters naturally evolve to crappy times and becoming evil and having their own little Breaking Bad narrative where they kind of lose their mind and become evil kingpins. That would be cool. And that's what he's
like. Multiple Breaking Bads combined.
And the trailer, the creators were talking about it, and it seems like that's their idea. It seems like they're like, we want to show that Gotham is a really shitty place, and it makes good people, and it makes bad people. And you don't know who's gonna end up which way. Like, and I think that that's really interesting to me. And that to me is an understanding of Batman. If they were like, we want to show all these cool characters and we're going to have penguins in it. And he's like skinny. So, you know, like that would bug me, but it seems like they have
this
deeper.
He's
tall now. Whoa. Like, it seems like they have this deeper understanding of what Batman's about, and I think that is cool, and I hopefully it will be okay. And if it's not, I'm just going to be sad for a while, so.
Yep, so basically what you're saying is that Gotham is a sort of nicer version of Detroit.
No, it's worse than Detroit.
I don't know if you've been to Detroit.
Actually, Josh, in Batman Eternal, the comic book that is out right now and everyone should read, there is a cop who says he's from Detroit, but he goes to Gotham, and Gotham is way fucking worse than fucking Detroit. So,
doesn't that mean that Batman's doing a really bad job then?
Well, that's always been the joke, is that Batman is bad
Batman
at his job.
Batman is the rent-a-cop of superheroes.
Like, both as a billionaire philanthropist and as a crime fighter, I think he's fallen asleep at the wheel here.
I don't want to get into it, but yes, you're absolutely correct.
Well, what he should do is when he catches these guys, he should just kill them.
Yeah. No, he should.
You know, I got a guy you could contact that's called Aiden Pierce. I think he'd set Gotham right up straight.
Oh, God, no! Campster, let's talk about what you've been playing, and you'd better not say Watch Dogs.
No, I haven't been playing Watch Dogs. Ever since that video finished, I have not touched Watch Dogs, so go me. I have been playing an eclectic mix of random crap that I don't know if you guys will want to talk about, but one thing I have been playing is Five Nights at Freddy's. I don't know if you guys have you guys even heard of that?
I am so not impressed by that fucking game, Campster. How do you not know about this game? All right, Campster, you talk, and then I'll talk about how I don't give a fuck about that game. Go ahead.
No pressure.
Seamus, have you heard of this game?
I've heard nothing. I keep hearing about, like, Twitter, everybody's talking about it, and I knew nothing about it. This is so weird. It reminds me of Gone Home, where it's sort of like I hadn't heard of this game before, and now everybody won't shut up about it all of a sudden. That was the same experience I had with Gone Home. But I know absolutely nothing about the game. I don't even know what the premise is or what genre it's in or what system it's on. I know nothing except that people are talking about it.
It's I hesitate to use the word survival horror, but that's kind of what it's been pegged as. So the premise is that you are basically working the night shift for what is essentially a rip-off Chuck E. Cheese, and that's cool, because, you know, you get to sit around in an office in a Chuck E. Cheese all night with crayon drawings and crap everywhere, except that the animatronic robots are set to free roam during the day so that they can not free roam at, or free roam during the night so that they, you know, can not kill people during the day, and it turns out that they're kind of homicidal, and they will track you down.
That's right. This is that game where, for some reason, the animatronic robots kill everybody at Chuck E. Cheese's, and nobody cares.
Well, you know, it's budget cuts. There's not everybody can afford to care. So you are a security guard who is sitting there trying to keep an eye on these robots for 6 hours, from midnight until 6 a.m. But you can't really leave your desk. All you can do is check the security feed cameras. But by checking the security feed cameras, they take up your whole screen. So you're constantly flitting back and forth between the actual room you're in and the different security cameras that each take up everything you see. So you can't see everything at once. And so they only move when you're not looking, sort of like those angels from Doctor Who. And they're really creepy looking, because they're like Chuck E. Cheese or the guys from Celebration Station if they were all evil looking. And they're out to basically tear off your flesh and put you in a robot suit. And it's not a scary game in an atmospheric sense. It's basically a jump scare engineering. It's a procedural jump scare machine. It is designed to generate jump scares,
yeah.
And it does it really, really, really well. Like, it earns the fact that it goes for a cheap scare. But anyway, Mumbles has opinions.
But it's still a cheap
this
scare.
This is the problem I have with it, and it's all context. Okay, if you, after the first night, if you realize how much you're getting paid to do this shit and you don't leave, then, because they don't pay you fucking anything, if you don't leave, then you're an idiot and you deserve to get forcibly put into a robot suit by robots. The other thing is, like, okay, if I ran that joint, I'd be like, oh, people are dying because of my crazy robots. This is very inconvenient for me as a business owner. I know what I'll do. I will hire a furry and bring that furry in and say, listen, this is the only job that you can wear your furry suit all fucking night long, and no one will give a shit. You can
wear
anyone you want.
There's like Easter bunnies and stuff.
No one's going to trust a furry to be an Easter bunny. So they're like, look, you can wear your fox suit, your whatever suit you want, all night. And you can hang out with weird robots that apparently have certain functions, like, go crazy. And then the furry would be happy because they can be themselves at their job, even though they're not getting paid much. You wouldn't have to worry about these robots, because they wouldn't try and stuff you in a suit, because you're already in a fucking suit, and then it's not scary no more. Like, I just, there's so many ways that it wouldn't be scary to me, and so whenever I see videos of it, I'm like, no one in this game is thinking, like, this is not a setup that I can believe. Like, and I know that my solutions for the problem are a little far-fetched, but at least they're fucking solutions, and not having people die every fucking time you hire a new person. Like, come on. Use some ingenuity.
But then you wouldn't have a fun game about being spooked by random mechanical lizards and werewolves and teddy bears.
Yeah. That obvious way to solve the problem aside, it's actually kind of a neat game, because it's so low budget, and for what they've done on such a low budget is super cool. Like, it's, to me, it's proof of how you should make indie games. You shouldn't make an indie game trying to do something over your budget. You should realize what your budget is and be like, I can make a cool game even though I only have these resources. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think that game is a perfect example of
it is oddly addictive in a weird way, because you're either going to beat the game or you're going to get a quick jump scare and then be done with it. And it's the levels only last, like, I don't know, 10 minutes, and there's only 5 of them, so a game lasts about an hour if you beat the thing, and if you don't beat the thing, you get scared, and yay! So, I don't know, it's kind of addictive and fun, and it's unbelievably stupid, but I kind of love it. I don't know, what else? I've been playing Distance, the racer game.
Not ringing any bells.
Are you going the distance? Are you going for speed?
I was thinking of the same thing, and I was like, I'm not going to go there.
Josh
gets
it.
And then you did.
Seamus gets it, too. Oh, my God.
No, it's
they're all alone in your time of need.
Yeah.
A while back, there was that Kickstarter that was all about a team that was from Digipen or wherever that were making a racing game, and it was inspired by things like San Francisco Rush, and I backed it, and now I got a beta key, and I'm having a lot of fun messing with it. It's kind of like San Francisco Rush meets Tron, I guess, because it's very electronica-y, very cyber world setup kind of thing. And I don't know, you guys know that I spend a lot of time just, you know, idly playing Race the Sun, and this is kind of like a slightly more challenging version of that, where it's a nice game to turn off my brain and just drive really, really fast around a big cyberpunk track and listen to vague electronica.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
Sold.
And it's got real floaty controls, but not the floaty kind that are, like, hard to control, but the kind that San Francisco Rush had, where it just gives you the ability to really maneuver the car up into places that a car couldn't actually go, because the car can actually jump pretty high and go up ramps and stuff. It's enjoyable. The only other thing I have is I kind of wanted to complain about the fact that The Sims 4 is being released after Labor Day, and that bothers me. I know by the time this goes up it will have been out, but it's Saturday night
man.
Right now.
Because it's The Sims 4 is the game that we really want.
Well, I'm going
so
to have to pick it up and complain about
great?
It, so... No, I'm gonna have to pick it up.
Sims 4 right now. Don't you, Josh? Aren't you just wishing you could be playing Sims 4 right
yes,
now?
Yes, if only I could be playing The Sims 4 and not have a pool.
Yeah,
you guys
that's
are so
the
lame.
Thing. You're sitting there playing The Sims 2 and you're thinking, I would love this if I just had like way, way less features.
Yes. Streamline.
No, you're
this
sitting
game.
There playing The Sims 1 and saying that.
So you do not anticipate greatness, but you can't wait to play it anyway.
It's not about not waiting to play it. It's more like this weekend I have a whole weekend free, and the last big game I played was Watch Dogs, and I kind of hated that. And while I'm playing a bunch of indie games that I'm really enjoying, and I'm playing too many random titles for 10 minutes to really go into them here, I kind of wish that I had a nice big game to sink my teeth into over the long weekend, and I don't. But the second, like, EA literally has on the Origin website right now a countdown to being able to unlock and play The Sims 4, and it counts down to midnight on that Monday, which is like, at that point,
what?
I'm midnight before I have to go back to work, and I'm like, oh, great, thanks, that's lovely.
That does suck.
That does sound kind of stupid to release after the long weekend when nobody has time for the video games. Like, the kids are going back to school. What is the thinking here?
I mean, Tuesday's generally release day, and it might be a global release date, which means they might not care so much about American holidays, but still, it just... You'd still, like, movies are smart enough to do this. Movies move their release dates all around, like, Memorial Day, 4th of July, all those sorts of things. Why don't games even consider this? Like, people do like having media over holiday breaks, and the games industry is just sort of, like, nope about it. Although I guess I will say that the end of the Labor Day weekend does signify, in some broad sense, the beginning of the rush to get things out before Christmas, because next week we have Sims 4, the week after that we have Destiny, and then we start actually seeing more and more major releases, and the drought of absolutely nothing to talk about will be over. So yay!
Oh, speaking of nothing to talk about, I've played The Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
Cold.
Me
that's
too.
That's a cold, cold, cold review.
That's my review, too. I don't know what to say about this. I can't even say anything bad about it.
See,
a junior bought me it, and I haven't
played it yet.
It's like when you go into an art gallery and, you know, there's interesting paintings and you see one and it's not a bad painting, but you have absolutely nothing to say about it. And somebody's like, huh? What do you think, huh?
That's painting.
Yeah, that certainly is hanging on the wall there.
See, my problem is every hoity-toity review of the game that could be written has already been written back when the game came out on iOS or whatever, so I'm just sort of like
stuck
in the cold.
So you can't write a hoity-toity review anymore.
I know, it sucks.
Okay, I like having the mountain play in the background, but the problem I have with that game is that it uses so many fucking resources. Like, it made my computer, like, freak out more than it does when I play TF2. I have no idea why.
That's what? Weird.
And why I wanted it to just be in the background so I can listen to rain fall on my mountain and every once in a while I'd be like, ping, the inside of me feels strange on this winter day. Like, that's what I want. That would be nice.
The mountain's getting kind of creepy. I thought that it was like the whole point, though, is you have it running in the background, like, and not, you're that, not actively doing anything with it.
If they fucking worked on the processes a little bit better so my laptop could handle it. You think my laptop should be able to handle Mountain? It can handle Titanfall.
How much RAM does your laptop have?
My laptop can handle Titanfall, Josh. I think it can handle a game about a mountain that sometimes talks to me about how it feels.
A mountain with like 100 polygons in it, yeah.
For real.
I wish I'd gotten there and written a review of the mountain. I'm upset with myself now.
So you feel like you don't want to write another pretentious review about it? You feel like the world's filled with pretentious reviews already?
And you for just that don't particular want to do game, one? Yeah. I've read lots of different angles approaching it, and I cannot think of a single angle to approach this thing from that has not, in some capacity, already been discussed somewhere.
You should decry the game, just eviscerate it. Tear
I'll
it
do
apart
it.
For the
I'll
graphics.
Record something for you, and then we'll pretend that
did.
It's you. And you'll be like, "Here's my review of Mountain," and it's just me shit talking it. It'll be great.
Guest reviewer mumbles, and it's just you saying the F word.
We should just make this
minutes.
A video podcast with the mountain playing in the background.
Oh my god, it needs to happen.
Oh, actually, that's a really good idea. If I could just if
this
if
is
you
a review
about...
of the mountain, everyone.
No, seriously, if you wanted to have like a really pretentious review, a video review that no one's done, it's just video of mountain. For, like, the entire 15 minutes, and then I don't say anything, and I just bring up the end credits immediately thereafter.
I want to make a mod for that game where I read aloud what the mountain says. Like, someone prints out a script of all the things the mountain says, so it goes ping, and then I'll read it. But then I'll add in some, like, bad words.
Or we could get Rutskarn to do it in the Dolphin Lover voice.
Oh
my god, the Dolphin Lover voice mod! Oh my god!
I like the idea of the mountain having an attitude. Oh yeah, this snow is the shit.
Extreme mountain.
I still can't believe you can die in that game though. That still shocks me.
If you remember the loading ready run, I'll link it in the show notes. But the loading ready run skit spring, where the one guy just completely loses his shit over spring and talks about how awesome it is. Like, that's what I want mountain to be like.
Yes, that's the review you need to do, Camster. Get really into it and do the most dude bro review you've ever done in your whole life. I believe in you. You've hung out with me. You know how dude bros talk.
Like an Angry Joe review of this is a badass game.
Explosions. You're like, oh, this is the most badass game ever.
Yeah, the problem is if you're going to do a joke video review, Total Biscuit already did one, so I don't know. I'd just be copying. Aww.
I like to drink Mountain Dew while I'm playing Mountain. It's the most
joke
game ever.
You do it as a Mountain Dew ad.
It's in the shape of a Dorito.
So now we come to the part of the diecast where we read questions from listeners and then make fun of them.
Die Deercast. In the past, such as his review of Somebody's Dreamer and in the diecast from earlier, Mr. Young mentioned how pleasant and unexpectedly powerful quiet endings can be in stories. In that vein, why do so few games do that and not grandiose Hollywood movie explosion bullshit? Is it because of genre restrictions or assumed audience expectations? Ira.
Because video games want to be summer blockbuster movies, and that's what summer blockbuster movies do. So,
also, I have things. Can I say things, or am I going to get made fun of?
Do it. Do it. Do it.
I'll be nice.
Both.
Aw. No, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of games are about system mastery, and so the end of the game is basically proof of complete system mastery, where you have all of the powers and all of the skill, and so we throw you up against a big mega boss that has an equal amount of all of the powers and all of the skill, and that's where a lot of that video game end gaminess comes from. We try to hide that these days a little bit because we're so narrative-focused, but you still have even... I mean, I brought this up in my Last of Us review. You still end up with games where the last level is, for whatever reason, the hard level, even if it doesn't have a traditional boss fight, just because that's a very gamey structure to prove that you've mastered the system.
The Last of Us was such a pain in the ass. I actually stealthed that whole level.
I was thinking how Bioshock could have benefited from a quiet ending. Like, how much better would the ending be if the ending was Andrew Ryan? Like, what if that was the actual ending of the game? Or even Bioshock 2, or not Bioshock 2, Bioshock Infinite, what if the ending didn't have some arbitrary, like, ship fight for no reason? Like, what if it was just like, now
you
things
mean,
are deteriorating?
The was just more of the multiverse bullshit? Because I don't know if I could have taken that.
No, I think that's just the story that they wanted to tell, and so it's not good, and I know it's not good, but I think it would have been more powerful if there wasn't the arbitrary ship fight that you had to do before you got all that shit. What they could have done is had it just slowly start breaking down once you fucking kill yourself. Sorry, spoilers. And then it could have just been like progressively more entwined and shitty and lighthousey or whatever. But it would have been a better ending.
Burial at Sea had, like, it wasn't a quiet ending, but I don't think there was like a big boss fight at the end. I don't remember actually. The ending of the part 2 of Burial at Sea.
Did you finish that? It had a fake out is what it did.
Yeah.
Because you had to go, you're like, oh, this is the boss fight. I have to go get this thing in the Big Daddy Maker area, and then you show up and it's a fake out. So yeah, I guess
they did
it
for that. Yeah,
and
then the Big Daddy starts wrecking things on your side, and then that's the end.
But for female purposes, I'm going to say that I actually wish it had a big fucking ending where you kick ass for fucking once in that DLC, because that whole DLC was about disarming Elizabeth, who is the most powerful motherfucker in the entire BioShock universe, and the ending of it was how. Making her weaker and weaker and weaker. And to me, it would have been way better if that wasn't the case, but whatever.
Like, the whole premise of that DLC was super weird. It's like, why does Elizabeth have to show up in Rapture at all? And then she becomes, like, kind of integral to what happens later on in Rapture. And weirdness.
I was kind of okay with that.
I don't hate that. I liked the story. You know, it kind of veered into that sort of disarming thing that you were talking about. But overall, I liked it. And the gameplay was way better than Infinite, so
that much
was enough for me to say, like, yeah, okay, this is cool. I give it my Josh seal of approval. But it was like the whole, like, when you step back from it for a moment and go, like, okay, this is where we end Elizabeth's story. Let's have it happen in a completely unrelated, like, setting for another game in this franchise that is, like, not directly related at all. It was shoehorned
to make it circular and be like, the circle is unbroken, fucking she's the one who started this shit, blah, blah, blah. Like, oh, more spoilers, my bad. And so I think, like, it was their attempt to connect the two games because fucking Bioshock Infinite didn't do it well enough. It just did it at the end. Spoilers, my bad. And so, I don't know.
Which it really didn't even need to do.
It really didn't at all, but fucking whatever.
More to the point about the climaxes being these big, grandiose boss fights, I think another thing is that everybody knows that films typically have their climax be this big action crescendo where the stakes are at their highest and everything's supposed to be happening. It's very narrative 101-y stuff. And for a lot of games where we don't have a super-duper strong narrative, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. Basically, we use the action in the game to supplant any tension that is actually missing from the actual narrative. So it's not really about the emotional stakes being high, but suddenly the systemic complexity goes through the roof, and it's like, you know it's the end, because suddenly it's every rule I've ever had to memorize for this game is being invoked, and it's the end. But as we get games that are, I think, a little bit more narratively engaged and a little bit more interested in actual characters, you see the games themselves pulling back from that reliance on mechanics to build that sort of tension. I mean, you get games like Gone Home or Little Inferno or Unrest or The Novelist or The Stanley Parable that all sort of have their own softer endings or no traditional ending at all. And that, to me, is a sign that I think we're maturing to a point where we don't need to rely on throw every mechanic at the player so they know it's the end kind of a crutch. And I don't know. I think it's those two things combined.
What do you think about the ending of The Walking Dead Season 1? I mean, that was kind of quieter. It did have that, like, big action sequence, but that was kind of leading up to the climax rather than going straight into the climax. And then the climax itself is this, like, quiet conversation with this dude who kidnapped Clementine.
And I think that underscores kind of what I'm talking about, where that game in particular really didn't rely on mechanical action to sell its characters. The tension in that game didn't come from the scene where you've got a million zombies and you got to hit them away. The tension came from this quiet scene where it's like Clementine, you, and a psychopath with his wife's head in a thing. You know, that's the scary tension room.
His wife's zombie head in a bag.
And it
his
was
wife's
just
living dead zombie head in a bag. That was
undead.
Spoilers are bad.
We should do a show about all the spoilers we do.
Yeah, we should do that. We should definitely do that. We should do The Walking Dead as a season on that show at some point. Like, maybe 10 seasons in.
Also, the challenge at the end of the game is often directly at odds with the narrative. So I think a lot of times they undercut it. Like, oh, I'm finally there. I'm finally going to confront this evil asshole, and I'm going to beat the evil emperor or whatever. And then you die 10 times in the boss fight. And when you finally beat him, you feel like, I didn't win. I cheated my ass off by just infinitely restarting from that checkpoint because I'm invincible, because I'm the player, and you don't feel like you earned a victory. You feel like you just sort of pushed through and you don't care anymore, and you forget why you were even doing it. And all the joy is sucked out of the story, and it doesn't feel like victory. And that's if they don't commit the unforgivable sin of, like, oh, you're back at a checkpoint, now watch this cutscene, skip it again, and then go back into it, which completely kills.
Do you think that's a holdover from, and I'm sure it is, but I was just wondering if you think it's a holdover from days where difficulty was gauged on how often you died versus how hard it is to do a thing? Like, would you rather have a boss where you have to die 30 times, or a boss where it's not that hard to beat him, but it's really hard to beat him with style, or to beat him perfectly, or to beat him,
with
finesse?
Yeah, I'd rather the latter one, because that gives me a reason to go back and do it again and perfect it. Where the first option is just murder, and it just makes me hate a game so much.
I guess that's why a lot of game design-y people in general, I think, like Deus Ex, where the first one, where a lot of the boss options gave you a lot of different ways to tackle them, and you could be kind of clever about it, instead of, you know, the one way where it's just, oh, I died, oh, I died, oh, I died, up, oh, I got him. And this, you know, Deus Ex allows you to come up with all sorts of clever traps and using death key codes and stuff like that.
That was the whole theme of the game. That's why that whole fucking game is amazing, because the whole theme is, you like playing a game, here's an obstacle, find a way around this obstacle. Like, it was a whole different, like, approach to, like, almost a puzzle-solving thing without it being an actual puzzle. Like, it's fucking genius. God damn it, Deus Ex. God.
All I remember about Deus Ex was that time when Seamus tried to play it, and it was haunted.
Oh, I remember yes. that. Good times.
And then Rutskern went crazy.
Oh, yes.
Okay, last email. Dear the Diecast, Josh, what is your background in the study of history? Is your interest personal, or has it been at some point professional?
I have, it is entirely personal. I have absolutely no academic background in history whatsoever, which is weird because my dad has a bachelor's in history. And doubly weird because I didn't get any of my interest from history from him. Like, we didn't ever really talk about history all that much. I went to school for computer science. You know, I was in a computer science program for a while, and then I was like, I don't know, you know, I'm not super great at the math, so I decided to take a break from that because I didn't really want to sit there doing classes at college and spending money and not know if I even really want to get the degree and not know whether or not I want to go to a different program. So I took a break from college, never really went back to it, because I already had a job at that point, and I was already making plenty of money. So it's one of those things where, like, I didn't see that much of a need to go and continue that. And plus, I never really liked, like, classroom settings, schoolwork kind of stuff anyway. So in that regard, I'm a bit like Seamus in that I don't actually have a college degree. And even when I was taking college classes, I don't think I even took a single class in history. So no, it's entirely a personal thing. Didn't really kind of get interested in history until sometime after I left college anyway. But I do read a lot about history, and I read a lot about, like, I read a lot of general information stuff by historians, and sometimes go into some more detail. At one point, I was I got into a tangent where I was reading actual letters that we found in Assyrian libraries, like between Assyrian kings and their advisors and vassals and whatnot, which was interesting because they actually do the whole, like, quote parts of the passage that in reply to what someone else is saying, and, like, in regards to what you said here, and then quote the passage, and then they say what they want to say, which was, like, I always thought of that as, like, an internet thing, where before the internet we didn't really do that, and then here the messages, like, letters from 3,000 years ago, where that's happening. But it's a personal thing, but I'm really quite passionate about it. You know, I read a lot about it. So if I give the impression that I'm an authority on any of these subjects, like, I'm absolutely not. And I try to avoid, you know, speaking authoritatively about too much in specific detail. But I do try to give the perspective that I have managed to accrue from reading these other perspectives from historians and other things like that. But no academic or professional thing, and I'm not even sure how I would turn it into a professional career. I mean, like, what does a history degree do for you? You know, I mean,
you teach,
like,
history.
How do you even become a historian? Like, it's an occupation, but, like, how do you do that? How do you make money doing that? You know? So I don't know. It's a completely, like, personal interest thing, like, in the same way that video games are for me.
Cool.
And that's all the questions we have this week.
Before we go, at the risk of derailing this entire thing too far, I just want to point out to Seamus that PC Gamer just released a list of 100 best games ever, and guess what game was number one?
Oh, I looked at the... It was Deus Ex, wasn't it? I looked at the list earlier today.
It was Mass Effect 2.
Are you looking at the thing I retweeted? Because they I swear I looked at the list and it was Deus Ex was the top one.
Number one PC game of all time?
No way. You're totally fucking
Mass
trolling.
Mass Effect 2?
There's no fucking way that is true.
Not like Half-Life 2?
We're not in Bizarro Land.
What the fuck is number two?
Skyrim.
What? No. Get out of here, Camster.
You're
going to
ruin this entire diecast. You have ruined everything forever, Chris.
Okay, I'm sorry. I knew it. Shouldn't have even brought it up, but I just wanted to see a reaction.
I'm looking at the list right now, and it says the 100 best PC games of... Oh, this is their 2011 list. I just Googled. I saw they had a list up, so I just Googled it. And I went through the list, and it seemed really, really... be reasonable, you know. I'd haggle over the order, but of course that's the whole point of these lists. But Mass Effect 2 being the best game of all time, it's not even the best Mass Effect game.
Well, Mass Effect 3 came in at number 8, so I don't know where Mass Effect 1 is. I'm still looking for it.
Oh.
He wasn't talking about Mass Effect 3 either.
Oh, man.
That
so what you're
offensive.
Saying is, 3 years ago, PC Gamer had a far better editorial staff.
Well, I think 3 years ago they had an editorial staff that was over 20. I think that's the key here, is when did you guys hire a bunch of teenagers that have knowledge that doesn't go back further than 6 years?
No.
What's number four, one of the Gears of War PC ports?
Hold on.
You know what? We're just
number
giving
four was
them
Deus
traffic.
X.
We're taking the bait on this bullshit.
Yeah, because you realize now this has to be linked in the diecast so people can see it.
Yes.
How is Mass Effect 2? It's Mass Effect 2, right? That they think is the best game that's ever been made on the PC.
Yeah,
how is that better than Deus Ex? How?
Deus Ex.
How is
that
possible?
People are talking about Deus Ex more today than they're talking about Mass Effect 2 today. I mean, it's just like the game has already lost that much of its relevance. Who here is like, oh man, the things in Mass Effect 2, replaying it over and over again.
In the top 10.
So yeah, that's really, really silly and childish.
Oh my god, I hate video games.
Yeah.
All right. Well, diecast is over forever now. We quit. Yep. Everybody quits.
I ruined everything for everyone. Yay!
It's all part of your dastardly plan to make Errant Signal the only video game show.
I'm just gonna go eat spaghetti on
your
podcast.
You're like fucking Hydra. Again. You show up. You make us think you're our friend, and then you destroy us from the inside. You stupid fucker.
FYI, I don't think Mass Effect 1 is in this list. I didn't do a thorough search,
but
I didn't see
it. Oh, you motherfucker!